This is The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. Please subscribe to this podcast at Apple, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts. Or go to reason.com/podcasts and sign up there. Has anyone lived a more interesting, influential, and inspiring life than Stuart Brand? Born in 1938 and educated at Stanford and by the United States Army, Brand was a merry prankster who helped conduct Ken Kesey's legendary acid tests in the 1960s. His guerrilla campaign of selling buttons that asked, "Why haven't we seen a photograph of the whole Earth yet?" pushed NASA to release the first image of the planet from space, which helped inspire the first Earth Day celebrations. From 1968 to 1971, he published the Whole Earth Catalog, which quickly became a Bible to hippies on communes and techno geeks such as Steve Jobs, who famously quoted its parting message, "Stay hungry, stay foolish." Brand has rightly been called the intellectual Johnny Appleseed of the counterculture. He helped shape early technoculture and cyberspace by reporting on the personal computer revolution and interacting with many of its key figures early on. His ideas were instrumental in the creation of The Well, one of the earliest online communities, and he helped found the Long Now Foundation, which seeks to lengthen and deepen the way we all think about the past and the future. In a series of books on everything from the MIT Media Lab to How Buildings Learn to Eco-Modernism, he's delineated a unique strain of ecological thought that embraces technology as a means of salvation and liberation rather than as a destructive force that must be stopped. His current passion is Revive and Restore, an organization that is leading the de-extinction movement by using biotechnology to bring back plants and animals, including the American chestnut tree, the passenger pigeon, and the woolly mammoth. Brand is also the subject of the excellent new documentary, We Are as Gods. That's a line from the first issue of the Whole Earth Catalog. The documentary takes a long, critical look at his life and work. And for today's podcast, I spoke with Brand and the directors of the film, David Alvarado and Jason Susberg, about Brand's long, strange trip that has taken place exclusively at the cutting edge of social and cultural change. Here is The Reason Interview with Stuart Brand, David Alvarado, and Jason Susberg. Stuart Brand, David Alvarado, Jason Susberg, thanks for talking to Reason.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
Yeah, pleasure.
Stuart, let me start with you. This is a movie that is a beautiful summation, a critical summation of your life and your work to date. What did you think of the film?
Two things. I thought it was a really well-made film. And one of the things I've learned when rewatching it is it's very rewatchable. The detailed work on it is so thick and fast that you get more every time you watch it for a few times. The other thing is as a film about oneself, normally I'm pretty bored by myself and my past. And to have it made interesting is quite an amazing thing to deal with. That's kind of a favor for a person who has that happen. So I was delighted on both counts.
I love the early description of you in the film as the intellectual Johnny Appleseed of the counterculture. Do you think that's an apt summary of who you are?
I was an Appleseed guy for the counterculture, and I've been other mythic characters for other people. In the sense that the Whole Earth Catalog was really a casting of seeds, a casting of bread on the waters, and not just bread, but all kinds of things, but cast on the waters. And in later incarnations, I was doing other things, but you're right, I was, Johnny Appleseed was really trying to help out the farmers, I guess, of the people living out in the landscape in America. There was a living out in the landscape aspect to the 60s that I think the people that Johnny Appleseed helped stayed on the countryside, and the people the Whole Earth Catalog helped in terms of communes did not last more than 2 or 3 years at the most, because the communes all failed, and we all went back to town, having learned very important things, such as that free love is not free, and When you rely on one guy for all the money, it's going to get distorted, and gardening is hard, and domes leak. And we got our noses rubbed in all our fondest fantasies at an early age, and that we were so lucky to have done that. It was way better than graduate school.
The movie begins and ends with your work on de-extinction and revive and restore. Could you do a make a quick case for why bringing the woolly mammoth back in the Siberian steppes or the passenger pigeon and the American chestnut tree? Why are these urgent tasks?
As it happens, all three of those projects make a lot of ecological sense. If there is a gap in the ecosystems those creatures were in that has not been filled by anything else, and if you bring them back, you not only increase the biodiversity, you increase the resilience, and from a human standpoint, the attractions and so on and so forth. But maybe the deeper thing is that we get caught up in our sense of sort of kind of a tragic sense of human damage, not only to each other, but to the natural world. And the idea that you can undo some of the damage, most of the damage was done unintentionally, and with intention to fix it, and then the tools to fix it with, the idea of undoing that damage is potentially, I think, very freeing. And I think it's a frame changer, the way seeing the photograph of the Earth from space changes the frame of how you think about things. If we can basically help nature heal itself from our previous misbehaviors, that not only helps nature, it helps us. We can move on from feeling guilty about what we've done with nature to feeling glad that we can actually go back and undo some damage. Undoing damage is one of the interesting ways to do good in the world.
You, at one point, you say that extinction of various species is a tragedy that can be unwritten. Mm-hmm. And you know, we need to use technology for that. Why do you think there is so much reticence among conservationists or, you know, on the one hand, conservationists who are maybe, you know, of a progressive bent, but then also of conservatives? Skepticism of technology, and I mean, the Whole Earth Catalog subtitle was tools or access to mm-hmm. tools. Why are we so afraid? I mean, what defines humans are that we use tools, but we seem terrified of actually using them in any mm-hmm. kind of concerted way.
I think there's a couple of illusions out there about nature. Ecology is what I studied in college, and island ecologies can be incredibly fragile, but where most of life lives, which is on continents and in the ocean, it's the opposite of fragile, and this business of life finds a way is incredibly real in the case, and so you can fuck up an island pretty quickly, but it's also the case that you can cure an island pretty quickly if we just get rid of the rats or the mice or the Arctic foxes or whatever did that screwed it up. Continents are where rather few extinctions actually occur. You'll have severe loss of population. You'll have extirpations where a particular species is no longer found where it used to be. So beavers have been gone from Scotland and England for 400 years. You bring them back and they fit right in and improve the landscape immediately and quite thoroughly. So that's one angle. Environmental organizations, well rewarded financially for telling a primarily tragic story with a couple of bright stories that the organization has been responsible for bringing back something or other, or saving some particular area that people care about or should care about. And the photographs are beautiful animals and whatnot. But what's weird is you basically can raise money with past human failures more than you can raise money with present human successes. And as a consequence, there's a tragic perspective that is rewarded. And that clears the pitch in terms of it goes against what you can actually discover when you do the science. And it's especially unusual. Conservationists have become very, very good at intervening in nature and basically helping nature find a way in cases where we have made it hard for nature to get past one particular problem or another. So you get remnant populations that are having a severe inbreeding, and means their fecundity goes down and they're headed down the so-called extinction vortex. You can turn that around with genetic rescue by bringing in basically a form of outbreeding, either through the lab or through bringing in animals with wildlife corridors and cool things like that. And then nature will heal itself. All you got to do is either get out of the way or give it a helping hand. And getting out of the way is something that conservation has become very good at. Giving it a helping hand, people don't know how good conservation has become at doing that. And so when we bring in a new toolkit of using genetics, that is met with more superstition than it deserves. But I think people are getting used to it. When in vitro fertilization first came for humans, there was all the usual resistance. It's hubris, you're playing God. All those in vitro babies are going to be sick somehow. They're going to be fucked up. And as soon as you had a couple of in vitro kids who were adorable and healthy, and you had ecstatic parents who could not otherwise have children, that just flipped. It just turned off. And so when we clone now a black-footed ferret or a Schimalski's horse, people are going, oh, the adorable animal. And you say, well, it's cloned, you know. Like, oh, really? Can I do that to my pet? And it flips.
What was your first tool? Do you remember as a kid, the documentary has some footage of you as a young boy walking around. You talk about having a free-range childhood. What was your first tool that you remember, you know, this is going to help me be more human?
I think what I was seeing was my father, who was a civil engineer out of MIT, just being incredibly handy. And there's a nice bit of footage of him working on a basement opening to our cottage in Michigan. He built Heathkit radios. All nerds of a certain age built Heathkit radios, and I did too because of him. So that kind of agency that comes with building things was something I got from that side of my family. And then from my mother, I got books and reading, and that led to writing.
Let me bring David and Jason in. David, Jason, give me the summary of why you were interested in talking or doing a film about Stewart's life.
Yeah, well, you know, Jason and I, we focus on the most interesting people in science, technology, and nature. And, you know, we had just finished doing a film about Bill Nye the Science Guy, and before that had done a film about these guys who wanted to extend longevity, essentially making youth last longer and longer and perhaps indefinitely. And so Jason and I are just fascinated with those kind of subjects. And Jason had suggested Stewart Brand back in 2014, which just seemed like a figure that was just so huge, and we didn't even know how to get in touch with him. So it just didn't seem possible, but we did get in touch with him. He was not available at the time. But then when we tried again for time after time, eventually in 2017, he said yes. And so we started our journey with him.
How did you first encounter Stewart's work?
Yeah, I think it was different for us. Interestingly, I grew up in Northern California my whole life. So I interacted with the world that Stewart helped create. I just didn't know or inspire, at least. And I just never knew the origin story of where the communes, came from and how we have this personal computer revolution. The sort of the seeds have been planted by Stewart. David and I grew up in that world. But the very first time I ever saw an artifact of Stewart's was at a used bookstore in Santa Cruz. I was going to school at UC Santa Cruz at the time. It was like 2000, the year 2000. And I ran across the last, I think it was actually the, it wasn't the last Whole Earth catalog. It was actually the epilogue to the Whole Earth catalog. And I opened it up. It was just on some dusty bookshelf. And to me, it was a glimpse of the past version of the future, because the catalog was very much a futurist manifesto, but it was from the 70s perspective. So I was just completely entranced by it. And I filed it away in the background of my mind of like, wow, what an interesting world full of domes and organic gardening and just random things that just were so delightful to my life at the time. And then I think the thing that really moved David and I together was Stewart's book on the Long Now found, or the Clock of the Long Now, which was written around that time. It was 2000, and I read it and just was completely sold on this idea that we need to have long-term thinking for our civilization to be maintained.
And when we're talking about long-term, we're talking about 10,000 years, right?
Actually, 20,000 years. The Long Now is 10,000 years back and 10,000 years forward.
So, you know, Stewart, one of the themes in your work, and you know, I think this certainly goes to the buttons that you made, calling for, you know, asking the question, why haven't we seen a picture of the whole Earth yet, a photo of the whole Earth, the Long Now, reframing computers from being kind of mega machines that dominate individuals to actually being tools that empower individuals. There's this, you know, a constant idea of reframing in a way that shakes things up. You know, how does de-extinction fit into that?
The way I feel I can have useful leverage in the world is by inventing genres. So not just a new thing within a known subject area, but a new subject area. And bringing biotechnology to wildlife conservation is not just a new tool set. It is brings a whole new perspective on what wildlife conservation can be and what humanity's relationship with the natural world can be. In that sense, it's sort of like when we got the photographs of Earth from space, it completely helped us rethink our relationship to the whole planet and how the whole planet works and how we blend in with that or fail to blend in with that. So in that sense, it's part of a continuity, and which I think is part of what these guys have done with the film, is indicate that these things look discontinuous, but they're not. They're actually all connected. Does that make sense to you guys, by the way? Did you have that in mind?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, it was, that was certainly sort of the perspective of the film, the perspective that we had going into making the movie.
Cool.
You know, one of the, going back to your early, I guess, and I'm thinking of Fred Turner's book From Counterculture to Cyberculture, where he discusses your kind of interest, and I guess you alluded to it when you talked about studying ecology. You, in the late 50s and early 60s, you were thinking in terms of systems when most people were not. Most people were just thinking of there's an action, then something happens, and it kind of just dissipates. What you know, what sparked your early interest in systems? Because that seems to be one of the biggest shifts that you have kind of brought to bear on many, many different conversations.
I probably got started in that through biology, which I came to through John Steinbeck's book about the marine biologist in Monterey named Ed Ricketts. And so when I was in prep school back east, I read Sweet Thursday and then Cannery Row. And Ed Ricketts thought about the ecological systemic way to think about biology in the oceans. And he wrote a great book, which is still a great book, called Between Pacific Tides. And he was also this mythic character who basically brought mythic framing to the world. And so Joseph Campbell was one of the people like Steinbeck, who was completely inspired by Ed Ricketts. Biology, especially when you look at it in terms of evolutionary ecology, which was my focus, is incredibly systemic. And to think of it in any other way, you just wind up collecting a few butterflies and that's it. And so basically, I've just brought a biological framing to everything I've done since. And so it's kind of fun this many years later to be doing biology again, only this time it's bench biology as applied to field biology. Back in my day, those went separate. And if you wanted to make money, you went into bench biology and dealt with cells and molecules, and DNA was just being discovered at the time. And if you went into field biology, you were going to have an adventurous life and never get paid squat, but it was worth it. And now those are convening, I think, in important ways.
So we've talked about systems. You talked a bit about making radios and things like that, that this, you know, building radio kits. You're also one huge impulse or thread through your work is a DIY, a do-it-yourself sensibility. Can you apply these two ideas to your experience with the Merry Pranksters and the role that psychedelics played in kind of bumping up to the next level of cultural change that you were involved in?
Well, part of what you do when young is try shit. And drugs were, we were reading Aldous Huxley's Doors of Perception when I was an undergraduate at Stanford. I met Huxley. And LSD was just coming available. Marijuana and peyote had been around for a while. My avenue in was really mainly through peyote because I was hanging out with Indians in the early 60s and joined the Native American Church. I actually am a card-carrying member. My mentor in that world was the vice president of the Native American Church, a guy named Holotso, a Navajo, near Window Rock in Arizona. And the Native American Church meeting, the peyote meeting, is a tremendously disciplined and actually difficult all-night thing that you do. And there's singing, there's drumming, and there's a lot of ritual in terms of the way things go around the fire. There's officers, there's a roadman, there's a cedar man, there's a drummer, there's the fireman, and then there's peyote woman who comes in the morning. That's five officers for a group that, you know, maybe just 10 or 20 people. And so I got to see a very productive and kind of medicinal, they call it medicine, group therapy in a way, version of psychedelics early on, and then wrote about it for the Psychedelic Review. And then at the same time, shortly after that, I'm seeing Ken Kesey's recreational approach to all that. I'd seen the psychiatric approach to all that, which is in Menlo Park with the group who was giving LSD to people in very structured psychiatric sessions. And I did that and kind of struck out, actually, but it was an instructive failure. And there was the sacramental version that my friend Dick Alpert, later Baba Ram Dass, and Tim Leary were pushing. It was kind of recreational spiritual. Mm-hmm. But you had all these versions of psychedelics, which was an indication of what a general purpose discovery path it was, and consequently very highly revelatory and sometimes quite destructive. But, you know, risk is part of what you're young for. So we were doing risky things on purpose to take advantage of being young and stupid. And then the transfer to personal computers was I saw people having more psychedelic experience with playing Space War on not even personal computers. They were still they were smaller than mainframes, the so-called mini computers, which were big as ice boxes, that you started to play video games, and then the power of programming turned out to be the tool with the most juice. And the programmers that I knew, hackers and young programmers at places like Xerox PARC and SRI and the Artificial Intelligence Lab at Stanford, they had long hair, they lived in communes, and they weren't doing drugs very much because they had found a better drug. And the better drug was computers. And so the opening line of my piece in Rolling Stone was, ready or not, computers are coming to the people. That's the best news since psychedelics. And lo and behold, it turned out that psychedelics leveled off. The drugs did not get better. The ideas of how to use them did not get better. And the opposite of the case, maybe because of Moore's law, of the computers getting better, and you had to run as fast as you could to keep up with what the capability was emerging was from computers. And so, go with the technology that has a future. So, and that's what the world did with computers.
A theme in certainly in your 60s work or life also had to do with individualism and of empowering individuals. Can you talk about that and about how, you know, how that is a powerful impulse in, you know, in creating society and creating community? And for you, what are the limits of individualism?
Good for you.
In affecting change?
Yeah, thank you. I got to revisit the opening line of the Whole Earth Catalog, "We are as gods, and might as well get good at it," when I did this book called Whole Earth Discipline, which was kind of apologizing for the number of things that environmentalists had gotten wrong in the 80s and 90s, 70s, 80s, and 90s. And so the opening line, in a way, of Whole Earth Discipline, which is a, 2010 book, is "We are as gods and have to get good at it." And I was basically reflecting on climate. But I didn't notice until later that while the two statements sound the same with a different imperative, they're actually completely different in that the "we are as gods" that was promoting the Whole Earth Catalog, we individuals, we young humans have these incredible powers and we should be using them to expand our capabilities and do things in the world and improve the world and discover the world and all that stuff. In light of climate, individuals can do almost nothing useful. It's we as a civilization. And one of the byproducts of the photograph of the Earth from space is we got to think about humanity as a whole, not only the planet as a whole, but humanity as a whole. And then, well, what is humanity to do? Humanity is civilization. And civilization bears relationship to the natural world in a different way than individuals bear relation to the natural world. And we've never dealt with that before. Now we're dealing with it now in terms of COVID, which is a global disease, a pandemic that is taking basically efforts by everybody to fix. And likewise, climate change is caused by everybody. It's going to take efforts by everybody to fix. And so the we this time is the opposite of the individual. It is the most larger scale collective of humanity that you can imagine. And so this is, I think, an important thing for your reason audience, because reason is focused on individual liberties, and that's really good, and to some degree individual responsibilities. And let's think also about civilizational liberties and civilizational responsibilities.
Yeah. One atom bomb can ruin your whole day, right?
You know, probably not. It'll ruin a whole city.
Yeah.
and I came late to a realization that nuclear Armageddon would be really terrible at about the level that World War II was really terrible, but not worse than that.
You know, but also at the start of, or the, in the credo of the Whole Earth Catalog, you talk about how power, as it was being wielded by large entities, whether it was, you know, giant corporations, giant states, cultural forces that were remote was not working well. What has to happen for government, say, or large-scale organizational change so that it's not repressive of people? I mean, how do we work as a civilization without becoming authoritarian, I guess, is one way of saying. How do we thread that needle?
I think we're going to keep discovering the importances of managing the commons that Eleanor Ostrom took on and got the Nobel Prize for increasingly over time. And one of the things she came to is a discovery that commons are well managed when they're managed by the whole community of people involved. And they declare boundaries and they have multi levels of responsibility. There's rules that people have to agree on and then abide by, or else, and there's no or else that has some teeth. And the scale of this bears relation to Steven Pinker's work on things like the better angels of our nature and the new enlightenment and so on, that humans actually have been getting better at a lot of things for a long time in terms of heading off various diseases, heading off poverty, and heading off a lot of things. And it's never stopped. We don't kill each other as much. We're not as unjust to each other as we have been. And there are different reasons at different times that it keeps getting better. And you can't count on the past ways of making it better to fix whatever the current problems are. You have to keep discovering new ones. And that is an amazing and wonderful quest for humanity, that is not settled how to fix pathological large organizations. You've got to figure it out. And so it's fun to read books like Kim Stanley Robinson's The Ministry for the Future, because he's showing a set of tough but realistic and over the length of the large book, optimistic way that these things can get better at large scale. Things getting better at scale is an interesting problem. And you've got to basically have everybody on deck to make that happen. And that having a whole planet come to a shared awareness of these problems and a shared sense of responsibility and agency to deal with the problems is pretty interesting. So things change. I've had to change my mind about nations. I thought that with the coming of the internet, I actually wrote it in a book called Media Lab. Media Lab said nations are going to fade because their boundaries don't stop the digital information and value going back and forth. And we do have a global economy. We don't have a global body politic, and we probably never will. So then what? And then you start getting into these multi-centric, multi-level ways of managing that a whole lot of shared information and a whole lot of investigative and productive science and then engineering lets you take on. So that the emerging capabilities and the emerging awareness keeps me optimistic in that sense.
I wanted to bring David and Jason into this. In 2019, Anna Wiener in The New Yorker, in an interview that she did with you, Stuart, about the 50th anniversary celebration of the Whole Earth Catalog, she wrote, and I want to put this in apposition to your optimism or your reference that we're getting better at dealing with many things. You know, fewer people starve, fewer people die violent deaths, die in wars, things like that. In many ways, the environment is getting better. She wrote, while antagonism between millennials and boomers is a Freudian trope, Brand's generation will leave behind a frightening, if unintentional, inheritance. My generation and those after us are staring down a ravaged economy, eviscerated institutions, and the increasing erosion of democracy. David and Jason, does that ring true for you guys, or is that part of the forces of pessimism, and kind of reactionary elements that Stuart has always been kind of working against?
Yeah, I don't see it. I can't speak for David here, but I don't see it as a generational struggle. I actually don't think that you can lay all the blame of a ravaged economy and a ravaged environment on the baby boomers. That's kind of, a simplistic take on it.
It is very satisfying, I have to say. Look, and I say that as somebody born in 63. I'm very happy to blame the boomers.
It's easy to rip on the baby boomers, like, let's face it. Yeah. But I think that it's actually more about, it's more about optimism versus pessimism. It's more about the world you want to live in versus the world that you're running from. And so I think that's just a kind of a trite take on it. And I think actually what's more interesting is the use of technology, the discussion between like whether technology got us to this problem where we have global warming, where we have an economic system in ruin, and whether or not we can use technological tools like, in the case of like Bitcoin or other sort of financial technology to get us out of current a current mini depression that we're in, or using geoengineering or other technologies to get us out of climate change. And actually, to go back to, the book that Stuart was referencing, Ministry for the Future, one of the most interesting technologies for the climate could be something that book talks about, which is a carbon coin. So I don't subscribe to that generational rift.
How old are you, Jason?
I'm 39 in 2 weeks. David is 36.
Okay, so you're a millennial. David, are you also a millennial?
I'm also a millennial. Yeah, I'm 2 years younger than Jason. So
okay, so
digital native millennials.
can I ask? Do you feel like you're inheriting a world that has kind of been burned down, or do you see a world where things are better than when you were a kid? And certainly better than when Stuart was a kid.
I mean, it's funny. You're asking that, Nick, at an interesting time, because a lot of the old timers now are saying this feels a lot like the 60s. I mean, there's just outrage in the streets. It just feels like society's burning down all over again for different reasons. And, I think you could write a doctorate on the similarities between then and now, but also there's a lot of differences that are interesting. I'm with Jason in terms of, hoping that technology can play roles to solve some of these problems. And, government policies do matter. So choosing the right ones is going to play a role in that. We have to stay politically active. But, I think that it's just really easy to just say it's technology's fault. Well, what's the solution here? What are we talking about? What is the solution that kind of person would be suggesting? Because I just feel like we need to be working on it together and building better tools, which goes right back to the 60s and what Stuart was talking about. Providing the right kinds of tools for people to make better decisions on their own has to play a role here. And that's what I'm interested in talking about. And so just criticizing is, again, way too easy to do. So I think that's only so interesting for so long.
Yeah, Stuart, if I may follow up on this a bit, there's a moment in Tom Wolfe's The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test where Ken Kesey is invited to an anti-war rally at Berkeley. And this is kind of a big moment in kind of 60s history, mythic history. And he gets to the stage and he says, if you're talking about politics, like you've lost the plot. And he kind of walks away from engaging politics as a means of social change. And not long after that, he kind of levitated up to Oregon and changed, his engagement with everyday, with political action seemed to completely disappear. I guess what I'm asking you is your work has also, you have spent a lot of time dealing with people who created things, whether it was communes or the acid tests or personal computing in ways that were built on certain types of government actions. I mean, LSD was introduced to American culture by the government, right? Computers largely, not fully, but in many ways, a lot of the sped up production came out of defense contracting and things like that. You worked for Jerry Brown as an advisor in California in the 70s. Can you talk about what is the balance between giving your life over to government and to kind of collective action and then maintaining the autonomy to kind of pursue, you know, the types of innovations or the types of things that are not bounded by government strictures, by bureaucracy, by the kind of organizational inertia that often causes as many problems as it might solve. How do you think about individualism versus collectivism in your work, in your life, and what is the balance that you seek to strike?
I'm a proponent, not an active one, of national service, Nate. I got so much from 2 years active service in the military, in the U.S. Army infantry. It was the best.
Were you drafted
did you? ROTC.
You were ROTC, right?
I taught basic training, and I worked out of the Pentagon because I was a photographer. It was the best possible graduate school I could have gone to. And there was pressure on me to stay in biology and go to graduate school at Stanford in biology. And as a result, when the new left in the 60s was calling soldiers who were drafted in Vietnam baby killers and actually spitting on them when they came back, this was not mythology, it was real. I knew that was an abomination, that I knew those troopers, I trained some of them, and the drafted people would be treated that way, I thought was just pathetic. And the military's longest-term thinking, later with Global Business Network when we were doing scenarios, our best client was Department of Defense because they think in 50-year time frame. And nobody else in business or in government was doing that at the time, or I think now. And because partly 50 years is what a weapon cycle takes. And partly the idea of national defense is a very broad remit for the military. So they were taking climate change seriously in Bush's Pentagon when the White House was not and the Congress was not. So we did scenarios on climate change for Andy Marshall at the Pentagon that then had to be taken seriously by the White House. And then when I worked for Jerry Brown, I saw a thing that knocked me out, which is that I saw governance, which is quite a different thing than politics. Government, the actual things that people in government do all day, was new to me. And it is shockingly new to most people. And we've had a wonderful revisit of that with Trump and the Republicans finally getting their, you know, drowning the government in the toilet like a kitten. They really almost pulled it off. And we got to see what happens when a whole bunch of things don't work. And you had a very good book from Michael Lewis called Fifth Discipline about that. Or the fifth something, not the fifth discipline of.
Right. So the fifth turn?
When management fails is one of the catastrophic things that can happen. Fifth risk, I think. Anyway, we did a thing called the Water Atlas that I set in motion in the Brown administration, the first one, that got me going down to the Department of Water Resources and other parts of the kind of down into the department's level of government. And I saw people were not very well paid, were incredibly good at what they did in terms of public service, who did not even know what party the people who worked around them belonged to, partly because they weren't interested and partly on principle. You're not supposed to be thinking politically when you're in government service. And I realized that Jerry Brown was a pretty good governor, but it didn't matter. Mickey Mouse could have been governor. And California's governance, which was highly skilled and highly effective and highly experienced, was going to keep plugging right along doing good things that people did not see or understand or appreciate. And that was, there was a libertarianism inherent in the Whole Earth Catalog and in many of my friends at that time, some of whom were survivalists and all this sort of thing. And I realized that a lot of the libertarian perspective was based on thinking that government and politics were the same thing. They're almost the opposite thing. When you think in terms of government and governance, a whole lot becomes clearer in terms of what you want and how you want it to work. So that's why I would love to see people doing national service. I love it when people intern for Congress people and get involved in, you know, local civics and on city councils and school boards and whatnot. That is a responsible part of engagement that most people only see if they get jury duty. And jury duty typically is revelatory to people. They see things going on outside the class. They see things going on outside the tiny bubble that they live in. And they see law, the rule of law, being applied in a really rigorous way that is impressive. So I just wish more people had that perspective and that would engage from time to time. Thank you for your service.
Two final questions, and the first one is for David and Jason. Are you guys on board with Stewart's call for national service?
Oh, come on, that's not fair. I mean, well, I think there's a lot of daylight between, Stewart's opinions on that and I think mine personally. I actually believe in freedom to choose whether or not you want to go down that path. I applaud people who do serve. I think what's happening in AmeriCorps is interesting, and their climate corps that Biden's talking about doing is something I sign up for, but I think I'm too much of a pacifist, I guess. I don't know.
Oh, I don't mean national military service. I mean national
service. Yeah.
Including
military service. Yeah, I mean, yeah, I'm open
that's,
to it.
That's a Rubicon. I agree with you, Stuart, that there needs to be a better appreciation for good. The government should be doing certain things, and it should always be doing them well and competently and be understood to be doing that. National service is probably a Rubicon I can't swim through. I guess a final question.
I want David to be on that.
Well, you know, yeah, if it's just military.
I'm in jail. That's sort of form of national service.
It's true. No, I mean, I feel like, yeah, military, that's a whole other thing. I mean, my brother-in-law fought in Iraq. Yeah, but I mean, national service, geez. Look, I think that it's good that there's all things. I mean, look, industry is going to be really, really good at doing one thing, and maybe the government shouldn't be doing what industry can do. But the government is going to be able to do things that industry is not going to be good at. And so I think wherever you're called to, wherever you, the person making this decision, is called towards, they should go in that direction, and those things should be governed by those bodies and institutions. And so I think it's the diversity of approach, I think, for a nation to take is the right answer, not one or the other. And so I think both are good. Is that hedging all bets enough for everyone?
Stuart.
Get Judge on and talk to him about infrastructure and talk to him about national service.
Well, we'll see, right, how it plays out in terms of infrastructure and the ability of government or private industry to really deliver on the next generation of what we need. Stuart, as a final thought, because we're about out of time, Your work was reintroduced to a lot of people when Steve Jobs, shortly before he died, gave a commencement speech where he quoted a line from the final Whole Earth Catalog: "Stay hungry, stay foolish." Do you want to revise that? You've revised the opening statement of the Whole Earth, or is "Stay hungry, stay foolish" still a pretty good navigational tool, a good astrolabe to guide your life by?
Well, it's definitely for the earlier we. And what I had in mind was sort of the freedom of the hitchhiker. And I commissioned that photograph that went with it on the back of the Whole Earth epilogue that you saw, Jason Susberg, that I sort of talked to Steve Jobs about why he loved it so much. After we did a gig together for the Library of Congress, he asked for me to sign that copy of that epilogue for him, and I did. I think for Steve, he was aware that wealth and power were going to drive him down paths that was going to take away what he cared about most, which was inventiveness and design. And it was going to be spending more time defending what wealth and power he had or he was creating, and that he would, the innovator's dilemma, I think, was on his mind. And staying hungry and foolish is a way to stay innovative. You try shit that is not rational until it is. Ken Kesey's line, if you don't boil rocks and drink the water, how do you know it won't make you drunk? So that's foolish. And young people specialize. They're perfectly equipped to be as foolish as they want. It's harder later. So
can you kind of chunk stay hungry, stay foolish up to the civilizational level? What's the analog then?
It's a really good question, Nick. I think that humanity is not going down an authoritarian path that would lead to a hierarchical lock-in. The empires that we keep worrying about in science fiction won't happen in those terms. It'll be more multi-leveled, pace-layered, fragmentary, some parts going very well, some parts going badly, different degrees of paying attention to each other. But a fair amount of paying attention to each other. And so Jared Diamond's book, Collapse, said, look, all these various civilizations have collapsed, but they didn't know about each other. And we sort of have a global civilization now, and we know about all those collapses that have occurred. And in the West, we pay a lot of attention to what happened with the Roman Empire. And this becomes time awareness and global awareness, giving humanity the ability, if not the necessity, to get out of adolescence, to get out of the kind of selfishness and stupidity that an adolescent is playing out, and to become a mature civilization. That knows how to take responsibility, that knows how to be disciplined, that knows how to be comfortable with diversity and cosmopolitan, increasingly sort of urban perspective on civilization. And that is in progress, and it's being forced to be in progress because of climate change, which is in a sense the version of Hungary that civilization is dealing with. And maybe the foolish part is just try everything. Explore geoengineering, explore ways to capture carbon right from the air if we can, explore the biological ways to do that. Put some iron in the ocean, and see if you can increase the biological fixation that goes on there. As David Mackay, who was the chief scientist for Britain, chief science advisor, he said, take nothing off the table. And that's what I think science at its best can do. You don't need a good hypothesis. Maybe you do for funding, but sometimes you can do these things without funding. Just go dead at it and boil rocks and drink the water.
Right. Well, we're going to leave it there. Thank you, David Alvarado, Jason Susberg, and Stuart Brand. If we get there, Stuart, it'll be thanks to people like you.
And you.
Thanks.
This has been The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to this podcast at Apple, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts. Or go to reason.com/podcast. Thanks for listening.